Stay relevant and up to date. Keep you informed. This is 101.9 High FM.
And this is the HID Hour. And my name is Stan Claff. I'm the Grand Secretary, calling you from Johannesburg. In a few moments, we will cross to Philadelphia, where we have a guest. In the meantime, just a brief update. Last week, we announced that we had had a successful visit by Rolf Meyer at a talk at the Dr. Herzl Lodge. We had an evening with Rolf Meyer talking about 25 years into democracy. I'm pleased to say that we had raised enough money to buy a defibrillator, which last week on Monday was presented by the Dr. Herzl Lodge to Hatzola, Mesh Bukets represented them. He came to our meeting and we handed over the defibrillator, and I'm sure they're going to put it to very good use. We have some other announcements to make while we're waiting to connect with our guest. If you want to call, you can WhatsApp 061-895-1019. That's 061-895-1019. Or SMS on 34519. We have some other projects in the pipeline, and most important of those, although all of them, of course, are important, we have a project going on, a day in the life of a Jew in South Africa, which is a photographic competition, and hopefully at the end of it, we will produce some sort of a book containing all the photographs. What we'd like you as the Jewish public to do is to take a photograph. You have the equipment. Your cell phone is more than adequate, and your smartphones today have very high res, good photographic equipment built in. All you have to do is take a photograph, send us that photograph with a little bit of blurb. Don't send us 1,000 words. Just send us a little bit of blurb explaining the photograph, and hopefully it will go into the draw. There's 25,000 Rand worth of prizes, but in addition to that, an opportunity to be published and to be part of a book which we will try to bring out later in the year. We're also launching our website, and that will take place in the next month or so, and photographs from the competition will be loaded into a section on that website. The website is of course going to cover all of our activities around the world, where we have lodges as far afield as San Diego, Boca Raton, Toronto, the whole of Texas. We have Houston and Dallas. We also have Atlanta, and of course in the UK, in London, in Israel, in Unana, and Jerusalem, and in South Africa, around the South Africa, Port Elizabeth, East London, Cape Town and Durban, and of course Johannesburg and Benoni, where we are carrying on our business as usual after 115 years of presence in South Africa, with a good working relationship with the communities, and the Hebrew Order of David, of course, present here for all those years and in all small towns, and something in the order of about 60 or 70 lodges around the country. I'm pleased to say that our guest is with us now. His name is Rabbi Arthur Wasko. He's from the Shalom Center in Philadelphia. Good evening, Rabbi.
Good evening where you are. It's barely afternoon where I am.
Okay.
You may be finished Purim. You're on Shushan Purim.
Correct. So, Chag Purim Sameach to you. And thank you for joining us. Just a little bit of about you. I saw somewhere that they describe you as controversial but lovable. I don't know which one. You're a prolific author and writer, and something of over 20 books. You lead the way in such initiatives as Global Warning, etc., and I'm sure with a Jewish slant. And today you want to talk to us a little bit about Purim, and let's see where the discussion takes us.
Okay. Actually, I'd be more interested in talking about Pesach, but we can get there.
It's coming up soon.
Coming up soon. If Purim is here, can Pesach be far behind?
No, well, not at
exactly,
all.
Exactly one Jewish month. That's how far behind. All right, so Purim the upside down, downside up holiday in Jewish life. Many societies, especially indigenous societies, have celebrations of early spring that are kind of crazy. Mardi Gras, probably borrowed from Purim in Christian tradition, linked to Easter, as Purim is linked to Passover. The rabbis, in fact, when they decided to have occasionally, seven times in 19 years, two different months of Adar, had to figure out, well, in which month of Adar should we put Purim? And they said it has to be in the second month of Adar, so it's close to Pesach, close to Passover. So it is. And it's a, modern scholars say that the story of Purim is not history at all. In fact, the Megillah, the scroll, the Megillat Esther, the Book of Esther, has a tip-off in the 10th chapter that this is all not true. It says you can find the whole story in the annals, the chronicles of the kings of Persia. Well, we have the chronicles of the kings of Persia, and this story ain't there. That line in the Megillah is a deliberate tip-off saying, okay, by saying it's real and you can read the history, we are tipping you off. It ain't real and you can't read the history. The story is a parody, a satire on a pompous king and a wicked prime minister, wicked evil prime minister, a pompous, empty-headed king. And the story is a joke. In fact, it's two jokes. It's two jokes with a very serious point, but they are the same joke. They are a very rich version of the joke in which the leading figure on the stage eats a banana, tosses the banana peel on the floor, and then, walking around, slips on his own banana peel and falls flat on his rear end. There are two versions, very rich versions, of that joke in Megillat Esther. The first one is, the king starts the whole story going by saying, no woman's ever going to tell me what to do, and no wife in my kingdom is going to tell husband what to do. And then he sets everything going by getting rid of Vashti, his queen, his wife, who has refused to appear before this months-long drinking party of the nobles of Persia. So he starts the whole story going that way, and at the end of the story, what happens? He does exactly what his new wife, Queen Esther, tells him to do. He has done himself a reversal by starting out, he threw the banana peel on the ground. That was getting rid of Queen Vashti. And lo and behold, the result is that he does take orders. Having said, no woman ever going to tell me what to do, he takes orders. He begs Esther to tell him what to do, and she does. And he does it. The other joke is much bloodier, but it's the same basic pattern. Haman wants to do in the Jews, and especially he wants to do in Mordecai, the leader of the Jewish community, and he even erects a gallows to hang or maybe to impale Mordecai. And Haman ends up on exactly the same gallows. He has thrown not just a banana skin on the floor, but a gallows in the capital city. And he is the one who ends up on the gallows. So these jokes are serious. They warn you that overreaching either anti feminism, you might say, anti-womanism, overdoing, in fact, you know, insisting that you don't want women to be equal and to have a share of decision-making power, that does you in, and you end up doing, living exactly in a situation where women have power.
Is that a sort of a warning for young married couples to, for the male to take cognizance?
Well, it seems to me the story is that. It seems to me it's one of, it maybe is the most feminist, well, along with the Song of Songs, it's the most feminist passage of the entire Tanakh, the entire Hebrew Bible. And people have been writing songs, about Vashti, making Vashti the co-heroine of the story by refusing to do what the king said. And the other joke, of course, is a joke, a powerful warning about anti-Semitism. And you might say that what the Megillah is teaching is that anti-feminism and anti-Semitism share the same basic kind of energy, a destructive, oppressive energy in the world. In fact, the thing that Amon says about the Jews, you know, they live all over the place, they have their own network of people, and they constitute a kind of threat to the top-down monarchical system. Oh, king, you should do them in, is really the same thing about the women. They live all over the whole kingdom, right? They have their own networks of connection, and even the ancient Midrash, ancient rabbinical Midrash, gets a tiny piece of it by saying that the king's courtier, his advisor, who told him to get rid of Vashti, was secretly Haman, who told him to get rid of the Jews. So it's very clear, and it's important to get what the lesson is.
Right.
Because there have also been, okay, another thing about the story. It's an exaggeration at every point. I mean, that's the way you tell jokes. You exaggerate. The exaggeration begins with this month-long drinking party, this royal drinking party, as if to say everybody in the entire kingdom, no, the ruling class, the barons in the entire kingdom get totally shikr, totally drunk. And from there, everything follows. No drinking party has ever lasted for months, but this one, according to the Book of Esther, did. So there's every exaggeration.
So from the Hebrew Order of David, which is our organization's point of view, so we are a fraternity. So obviously we women are excluded from our organization, although of course all of us are married and we interact with the women, and of course we have a good support base from our women and the ladies with who we're associated with. From an anti-Semitism point of view, we've stood since 1904 against anti-Semitism, and it's one of our strong foundations, and I think today it's become more and more relevant. So the story of Haman is of Purim is really relevant to us because, you know, of our stance in the world and how we try to, do our best to thwart it and, you know, make sure that we as an organization hold our head up as Jews and in that way we try to provide the light against anti-Semitism, which is really our rationale.
Well, that's great. The problem emerges in chapter 9 of the Megillah. In chapter 9, the Jews defend themselves against the attackers. And that's fine. It's clear there were, according to the story, but remember, the story is not history. It's a lesson, but it's not history. But then the story in its jokey way, exaggerates, and then says the Jews killed 75,000 persons. Well, as long as Jews were telling this story as a way of energizing themselves, but did not have the power to subjugate other people, the story was a really helpful, good story. But 25 years ago today, in the Jewish calendar, on Purim, 25 years ago, an American-born Jew who was a settler in an Israeli settlement on the West Bank, the occupied West Bank, right outside the city of Hebron, on Purim morning, deliberately took himself a machine gun, went to the Cave of Machpelah, the burial place of Abraham. I'm saying it three ways, in Hebrew, in Arabic, and in English, because in all three languages or all three cultures, Abraham is seen as a really major figure by both the Jewish and Muslim communities, and if you want to look at it ethnically, by both the Jewish and Arab communities, Abraham, is seen as the great teacher, progenitor, founder. And this guy, whose first name was Baruch, which means blessed, killed 29 Muslims who were prostrate in prayer. And he did it because he was obsessed with that passage in the Megillah about the ancient Jews in Persia killing 75,000 Persians. So that is a terrible, a disastrous misreading of the story.
Yes.
The story is about self-defense. It's not about murder. It's not about subjugating another people. The story is a warning, a joke, and to think it was history and he should obey it. The rabbis taught that on Purim we should get maybe drunk, some translations say mellow, which might open up other avenues besides alcohol, to get there to a spiritual place where Baruch Mordechai, blessed be Mordechai, and Arur Haman, accursed be Haman. We can't tell the difference. Alo Yada, to the place where you don't know. You don't, it's not just knowing intellectually, but you don't grok, to use a Martian word that entered English from a science fiction writer named Robert Heinlein. You don't absorb, you don't make a deep emotional, intellectual, bodily connection with the difference between Baruch Mordechai and Arur Haman.
It's a very relevant moment because of what's taken place in New Zealand. I mean, the other extreme, and it's a sad situation that there's in these individuals, these rogues, who just go out and randomly shoot people just for the sake of doing it in the name of religion or in the name of whatever. And that is the sad part about it, is that, and you can't identify these people ahead of time.
Well, you can identify not specific individuals who tip over from crazy hatred into violent hatred, but you can try to guard against the hatred when it hasn't yet turned violent. You can, and one of the problems is that the present president of the United States is acting not yet directly violently, but acting like Haman. and a lot of, I don't know about South Africa, but in a lot of U.S. Purim spiels today, yesterday, last night, he was Haman. The president was Haman because he has been willing to even kill children on the border between the United States and Mexico, because he has defined Mexicans and Central Americans as less than human, has split families, tearing children away. He's issued the orders that have done this, which is exactly what Haman did in the story, or intended to do. And the story is a warning, I would say, whether Jews or anybody else, that we must not behave that way. That it is incredibly self-destructive. What the story says is the one who starts out doing that to other people ends up himself done in. And that's the story of Passover too. The Pharaoh, who starts out a god, ends up his power and himself dissolved in the Reed Sea.
So Rabbi, we're going to take a momentary break. When we come back, we're going to explore that situation further. If you'll just hold on the line, we're going to just take a few ads.
A frequency like no other.
101.9 High FM.
And you're back with the HOD Hour. I'm Stan Claff. We have on the line Rabbi Arthur Wasko from the Shalom Center in Philadelphia, the founder of the Shalom Center in Philadelphia. Rabbi, just before we move into what we were discussing, we have the Genealogical Society, the Jewish Genealogical Society of South Africa. We run it from a center, which is the Hebrew Order of David Center in Johannesburg. And it's interesting that we are on the 31st of this month. That's a week almost from today, or from Sunday. We have a lady from Bolivia who lives in Israel. Her name is Margarita Curtis, and we are going to have her as a guest speaker, and she's going to be talking about the journey of the history of the Jews in Latin America, where they came from, to building their communities, and all the stories behind the scenes. That's the 31st of March at 7 p.m. at the HRD Center. So we're very involved in bringing information about Jews from all around the world. And it's just interesting, we were discussing Latin America and the issues around the wall. And we're back with Rabbi Arthur Wasko, and we were discussing the significance of the wall and the problems surrounding, I suppose, white supremacists and anti-Semitism, etc.
Right. Thank you. Glad to be back with you this moment. So one of the things that distresses me a great deal on this 25th anniversary of when this person whose name was Baruch, I was saying that the rabbis taught us we should get to a spiritual place, a high place, where Baruch Mordechai and Arur Haman are dissolved into each other. So he thought he was Baruch. His name was Baruch, blessed. He thought he was Baruch. But the way he acted was Arur. He cursed. He couldn't tell the difference between being a blessed person and being an accursed person. It was the Purim story in its depth just torn apart, it seems to me. On the day after an evening of wonderful Purim spiels and costumes, I woke up the next morning, 25 years ago, turned on the radio, heard the news, and what came to me was this, that, you know, the name of God is never mentioned in the Megillah, in Megillat Esther. And the only other book of the Bible where God's name is never mentioned is the Song of Songs. There, it's because, I think, God is ever present in the story, is present at every moment in this spiritual and erotic, not one or the other, but both simultaneously, story of love. So it's God's love, it's the love between human beings, it's the love of human beings for the earth, it's the Garden of Eden for grown-ups, and in the Garden of Eden story, God is giving orders. In the Song of Songs, which I think is the Garden of Eden for grown-ups, God, the parent, is no longer there because we learned the deep ethic of love. But in Purim, I think there's another reason. I'm not saying this as a historian, which I am too, but I'm saying it in the kind of moment of deep horror I felt on that morning 25 years ago, that the reason God's name is not in the Megillah is that God, reading the line about killing 75,000 Persians, said, no, you can't have my name here. I take my name out of this story. You're not allowed. And what's more, I can see into the future that somebody actually thinking that it was the right thing to do killed 29 of my children with my other community, my other family of Abraham, the other family I love too, of Abraham through Ishmael. No, you cannot use my name in the Megillah until your peoples stop murdering each other, until the children of Isaac and the children of Ishmael stop killing each other, all the children of Abraham. Then, in that day, my name will come back into the Megillah. That's what came to me that terrible morning.
So, Rabbi, in a world that is increasingly anti-Semitic, but also increasingly anti a lot of other things, where do we stand and where do we go? Where does the individual make a difference in this type of scenario? I mean, we all rail against it. We talk about it, but in a sense, as individuals, are we able to do something about this in a stronger way? I know you're involved, but you've set up a center and this is your work. But as individuals, going about our daily lives, what do we do?
I think we have to work not only specifically against anti-Semitism, against Islamophobia, but against the subjugation of women and the subjugation of the gay, lesbian, etc. community. We have to work for justice in the society as a whole. And we have to work for justice in the earth as a whole. I think certainly our experience in the U.S. is that anti-Semitism and racism and homophobia and Islamophobia get worse, a lot worse, when part of the society is experiencing economic and cultural marginalization. People who were feeling themselves shut out more and more and more from American society and kept feeling, I don't belong here anymore and my kids don't. And in fact, there's a whole group of Americans for the first time in history that their life expectancy has dropped. That's not been heard of for 300 years here. Out of despair, people talk about overdoses of the opioids, but many of those cases are not accidental overdoses. They're people deliberately committing suicide because they don't see a future. We have to make sure everybody sees a decent future. That means we have to face the danger to the planet. There are now tens of thousands of high school kids who went on strike this past Friday all around the world, in America, in Europe, all around the world, went on strike demanding that their governments act about the climate crisis. Central Africa there's now a huge flooded lake where there used to be farmland. Just in the last week, an overwhelming rainstorm, and dozens of towns washed away and the people drowned. That's because of the what I call global scorching, not warming. Warming seems so pleasant. scorching. It's not pleasant.
And it's right on our doorstep. It's in Mozambique, all our neighboring states.
Right, exactly. I mean, I know you're closer to it than we are, but it happened here too. And here it took the form not only of floods and ultra hurricanes, wild hurricanes, wilder than ever before, but it also took the form of these incredible wildfires in California, unheard of. California has long had some wildfires, but these were totally out of control. And a society that's facing permanent disaster is a society that will begin to try to take it out on some minority, whether it's Muslims or it's Jews or it's blacks or it's Mexicans and Central Americans, people who feel there is no future for them begin to look around for people to beat up on. And so there is a real connection. And sometimes it seems to me the best of Jewish life, which looks seriously into Tikkun Olam, into healing the world, thinks that healing the world is only about social justice, not about planetary Earth justice. And our tradition teaches they're deeply, deeply connected. Passover is not only about the subjugation and attempted genocide of the ancient Israelites, it's also about plagues. We call them plagues. They were, when you look at them, they were ecological disasters. Undrinkable water, overwhelming locusts, hailstorms that the text said was totally unprecedented in Egyptian history. And when Pharaoh's advisors came to him, the seventh or eighth plague, and said, "Don't you get it? You are ruining your own country. Stop. Let these folks go. They want to go. Let them go." He couldn't do it. He couldn't, because he was addicted to his own power. We have to deal. So there's an intimate relationship between democracy and a reasonable level of equality, not with, 300-to-1, difference between the president of a corporation and the person at the bottom of the scale. There used to be in American society maybe 7-to-1. Now in some of those corporations it's 300-to-1 difference. So we have to deal with all that. So that means Passover matters. And moving, I sometimes think that Purim is trying to undo the tyrant with the joke. And if that doesn't work, then a month later we have to figure out about how to undo the tyrant with a nonviolent resistance, where the story really begins, not with Moses and Aaron and Miriam, the story really begins with two midwives. Pharaoh says, "Kill the Israelite baby boys." And they won't do it. They disobey. They won't do it. And then they won't do it. It was like sort of semi-passive resistance. It was resistance. But, and then, Miriam and Pharaoh's own daughter create what I call an international feminist conspiracy to save Moses' life and make it possible for the liberation to happen. So, I think, 50 years ago, in the wake of the murder of Dr. Martin Luther King, which the president then of the United States, Lyndon Johnson, responded by sending the army, well, there was something in between, of course, black neighborhoods in Washington, D.C., where I was living, and black neighborhoods all over the United States erupted in rage at the murder of this incredible nonviolent leader. And the president sent the army to occupy the capital city of the United States. I was living there. I saw it. I watched it. They took over schools where, in my neighborhood, they took over the major streets. And the president proclaimed a curfew. So the curfew in theory applied to everybody, but the police didn't care if white folks were on the streets. There were thousands of black folks arrested. The only charge was that they were on the streets, not they were being violent or anything. They were just violating the curfew. So a whole bunch of us who had been white civil rights activists or anti-Vietnam War activists got together to create a network to get food and medical supplies and lawyers and doctors into the black community, which was otherwise cut off, couldn't even go to a grocery store because of the curfew. So that's what we were doing all day and all night and for a week. And then came the first night of Passover. So as a grown-up, I should tell you, looking back that 50-some years, I had stopped being interested in Jewish practice and Jewish holidays, except for Passover, because it was about freedom. And I had grown up in a household of socially active mother and father, and even grandfather. And we did the Seder in English with a serious eye to justice and freedom. So I walked home a week after Dr. King was killed, came the first night of Passover. And I walked home to get ready for the Seder. And that meant walking past the U.S. Army and walking past the Jeep with a machine gun pointed at the block I lived on. And my kishkes, my insides, my innards, more than my brain, began to say, this is Pharaoh's army in the streets. I'm going home to do this Seder about liberation from Pharaoh, and here is Pharaoh's army in the streets. And that awoke in me for the first time as a grown-up, a really serious, explosive, not just serious, like a volcano, energy. Oh, Jewish teaching has something to say to me that I didn't even realize. Even though I was serious about the Seder, I didn't realize the power that it was really calling forth in me and speaking out of what was happening around me. So that turned my life in a whole new direction. I wouldn't be a rabbi today if it hadn't been for that week after King was killed, Passover beginning. And now it's 50 years. Because we, on the first anniversary of Dr. King's death, he died on April 4th, 1968. On April 4th, 1969, we created a Seder that I wrote, which for the first time ever in Jewish history wove the liberation of another people, Black America, together with the liberation, the ancient liberation of Jews, of ancient Israelites from Pharaoh. And we actually created a Seder out of that, what we ended up calling the Freedom Seder, Haggadah. And it's 50 years, and in honor of the 50 years, and more in honor of the sense that we are stuck again with pharaohs worse than 50 years ago in the United States, we are having a 50th anniversary Freedom Seder with major leaders of the resistance to our pharaoh in chief and all his fellow pharaohs, Reverend Dr. William Barber, who many people said is this generation's Martin Luther King, incredibly bright, incredibly committed, incredibly eloquent and activist, as one of the leaders of the Seder, and several other people, one of them you may have heard, even in South Africa, of two women who confronted a U.S. senator about the issues of feminism and assaults on women during the hearings over the last appointment to the Supreme Court. Two of those women confronted a U.S. senator in the elevator and insisted on having a serious conversation with him, which to some extent partly changed his mind. One of them is going to be one of the leaders of the Seder as well, Ana Maria Archila. So we're doing this, and although we're doing it in Philadelphia, folks in South Africa can actually get to watch in and hear it. We're live streaming it, and the live stream will work anywhere on the planet. So it's the live stream. You have to register for it, and it's tinyurl.com, tinyurl.com, and then a slash sign, Freedom Seder 50 Live. The live is for live live streaming.
Is this the origins of the Shalom Center? Is that how it started? Is that where your work
is? It came out of that. It took a while, but it came out of that. I wrote a lot. I published several books about Judaism that would be renewed and transformed and take seriously the Jewish obligation to heal the whole world, tikkun olam, not just to heal the Jewish people. And then I was invited to teach at rabbinical college, the Reconstructionist Rabbinical College, and out of all that, we created the Shalom Center. Out of all that energy, we created the Shalom Center. We began in 1983, so it's now 30-some years, 36 years, I guess. Nice number, come to think of it. But the 50 years of the history of the Freedom Seder, which was not just at the beginning and now, but all along, one thing it did was many, many Jews and some Christians too decided to liberate the Haggadah, you might say. So what freedom was to person X, you know, became the basis for writing a Haggadah. There have been ecological Haggadahs. There have been Haggadahs about war, about the nuclear weapons back in the 80s and 90s, about war now, Haggadahs about Israeli-Palestinian struggles, which keep the basic form and the symbols and then explore new aspects of it, new aspects of freedom. What is freedom?
So Rabbi, we're gonna thank you for your presence and for joining me tonight. Very interesting points of view. You know, to learn another side of life and another way of thinking about these things. It's something that, you know, everybody needs to consider their own interpretations, but clearly you have thought this thing through. You've been 50 years in doing this, and I'm sure people are interested. If they want to get in touch with the Shalom Center in Philadelphia, I presume that has a URL, an address, or phone number.
Yeah, shalomcenter.org is our website, and on it you can find information about the Freedom Seder. You can find how to sign up for our weekly blog, all of that. TheShalomCenter.org.
So thank you.
And thank you for inviting me, and I hope I've given a new twist to the ancient twist of the story of Esther and Haman and Mordecai and that stupid king. So I'm glad to have been able to spend this time with you.
Just one last word before you go. Just tell us your age.
I'm 85 now.
Wonderful, and mazel tov, and have a
good, thank you,
and have a wonderful rest of Purim and a wonderful Pesach that's coming up, and I'm sure we'll be in touch. Thanks for you
wonderful.
All for joining
thank
me tonight.
Thank you.
Good night.
Be well.
A frequency like no other.
101.9 High FM.
And you're back with Stan Clef on the HID Hour. Decided this week, due to the fact that it was Purim, and Rabbi Wasko has had a particular angle to it. We wanted to discuss with him what he thought, and it's always food for thought. It's not necessarily the views of the Hebrew Order of David, as but we're a Jewish organization, and I think we should explore different points of view in making up our minds about what we should do and how we should do it. And of course, he stands firmly against anti-Semitism, and that is the core of our organization, anti-Semitism, assimilation, and of course, Chesed and the charities. And we have some projects on the go, which I'd like to tell you about. First of all, the Dr. Herzl Lodge, the oldest lodge in the order, formed in 1904. On the 5th of June, they have a golf day, which is an annual event, and it's a fundraiser, and the Dr. Herzl Lodge is proud of their tradition in giving away money, and also whatever they do, they work it towards the charity and towards Chesed. It's a big part of that organization. And that's on the 5th of June. If you want to contact us, you can contact the Hebrew Order of David at 011-640-3017 or admin@hodavid.org. On the 16th of May, we are happy and proud to say that we have an event which we hold every 3 or 4 months, which is for the Royals, which is for elderly members in the community. You can come along in the morning, and that morning is the 16th of May, and we usually have an entertainer and some tea and biscuits. Of course, we wouldn't let you go hungry. And the entertainer this time is Cantor Ezra Scher from the Pine Street Shul, who will be entertaining everybody. It's free. Just contact the Hebrew Order of David. Let us know, or if you're in one of the community homes, or you have contact with people, just come along. There's no need to book. There's ample seating, and there will be ample food, etc. The number to call is 011-640-3017. On the 29th of August, we also have an event taking place, which is our annual memorial meeting, in which we honor members of the order who have passed away and families, wives, of the widows of the members of the who have passed away over the years, are welcome to come along to the evening. It's not a long evening, but it's a very poignant evening. It recognizes the work and the efforts of our brethren, as we call them, have done over the years, and we've been around for 115 years and in the community, and we like to pay respect to them. Going to wish you good night. I hope you had a wonderful Purim. Enjoyed the day, and we'll see you next week. Good night.